The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello there, this is Fred Brack reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving our community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now it's time to return to Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina, the November 2022 edition that they are kind enough to send us for reading to you. And the theme this month is Carolina Born and Bred, seven stories of our state animals. And now that we've gotten through the pictorial, we're going to get into those state animals, starting with the state dog. You know what that is? Okay, you don't. It's the plot hound. That's P-L-O-T-T. Carolina born and bred, six generations and counting of the Plot family have bred a hound renowned for its tenacity, bravery, and indelible ink to the Tar Heel State. Written by Mark Kemp. There is a picture of the full-bodied dog. It's kind of a, what I would call a brindle color, brown, with little, kind of little, dark stripes. I don't want to call them black, but it's almost like there are little stripes around. And then there's a close-up of the face. And, of course, he's got his, or she, has their tongue hanging out between those two lower incisors. And you can see that same sort of brindle mottling on the face and brown eyes. And the caption by the picture says, "Some say that the plot hound is a direct descendant of the Hanoverian Schweißhund of Germany, but expert Bob Plott believes there may be many other breeds in the mix." Dogs seem to be everywhere on this pleasant Maggie Valley morning. Lined up along the banks of Jonathan's Creek behind the Meadowlark Motel, baying from the beds of huge pickup trucks parked in the Vintage Roadside Inn's lot, sitting dutifully next to their owners around picnic tables scattered about the large grassy area out back. Dogs, beautiful, muscular, lanky hound dogs, specifically plot hounds. Every summer, just as sure as May turns to June, the organizers of Plotfest in this gateway to the Great Smoky Mountains brings local hunters together with other enthusiasts of North Carolina's official state dog for a celebration of all things plot. You have your black plots, your brown plots, your buckskin plots, and perhaps most remarkable of them all, your brindle plots with piercing hazel eyes. You have your best-in-show plots, your baying and treeing plots, and your babysitting the kids while the adults talking or the adults talk bear hunting plots. And you have Bob Plott, the 66-year-old keeper of the breed's history. His great, great, great grandfather, Johann Plott, emigrated from Germany in 1750, bringing along five of his prized mixed-set hounds bred for hunting large game in the Black Forest. It is believed that after landing in Philadelphia, the teenage Johann made his way south to a Swiss-German colony in New Bern. From there, he began his move westward across North Carolina, eventually heading up to what's now known as Warren County, then down to Cabarrus and Lincoln, where he started a family and kept refining his breed of fearless, intelligent dogs. His son, Henry, continued west, ultimately settling with his family in Haywood County, where the dogs, now known as plot hounds, have been used for more than two centuries to hunt bear and wild boar. To Bob, the story of his ancestors and their dogs is nothing short of epic. It's classic Americana, he says, with roots that run deep throughout the state on so many levels. Indeed, the tale of a family trekking west with their namesake hunting dogs in tow checks all the boxes for great cinema. There's buffalo along the way, there's panthers, there's Indians and outlaws. It was rough, Bob says, as he thumbs through a family photo album of images, many of them dating back to the 19th century. But they had these dogs that were hunters, they were herders, they were protectors, they were friends. They defended households during the French and Indian War, during the Revolutionary War, the Civil War. He pauses and shakes his head. It doesn't get any more American than that. Hang around Bob long enough, and names like Uncle Fed Messer, Wid Medford, and Turkey George Palmer will roll off his tongue like bourbon barbecue sauce on a fresh bear meat. All of those rascally gentlemen were North Carolina bear hunters who pursued their quarry using the uncanny tracking abilities of plot hounds. When he was about 10 years old, Bob, who was born and raised in Statesville, began spending summers with his relatives in Haywood County. Guys like his Uncle Cecil, who ran the Bryson City Railroad Depot and took Bob on hunting trips, and his cousin Vaughn, one of the most famous plot hound breeders of the 20th century. They'd sit on the front porch, pick guitars, sing, and tell stories into the wee hours about wild adventures that may or may not have actually happened. Sunday afternoons were all about, "Let's go to Vaughn Plott's house over here on Plot Creek," Bob says. And for me, that was like getting to sit down with a bunch of NFL players. These guys were celebrities. They were rock stars. I'd be thinking, man, that's the guy who first got the dogs registered back in 1946. Now he's old, he's crusty, he's cussing, and he's telling these great stories. Plot hounds first gained national attention in 1935 when Baseball Hall of Famer Branch Rickey went on a legendary hunting excursion with Vaughn and some others in the Hazel Creek area of the Smokies. News of the famous slugger's appearance went what we'd call viral today, and young Bob loved to hear Vaughn tell the story. "I was in awe," he says. "I mean, this was the man who integrated pro baseball when he signed Jackie Robinson to the Dodgers. I still have the letter on St. Louis Cardinals letterhead that Branch Rickey wrote to Vaughn saying, 'You have the stamina of a professional athlete, and your dogs are amazing.'" As he grew into his teen, Bob, who had always taken his family's plot hound history for granted, developed other interests. After high school, he attended Western Carolina University, then later worked for years in the textile and racing industries. Meanwhile, in 1989, other plot enthusiasts were making a case for designating the breed as North Carolina's state dog. Senator Richard Swain of Buncombe County introduced the bill, and then in April of that year, State Representative Hugh Lee of Rockingham brought his plot hound, Lucy, with him to a Senate committee meeting. Lee and Swain spoke of the dog's uniqueness to North Carolina, as well as its phenomenal hunting abilities. Not only did the breed's sensitive nose's passion for the chase, strength and agility, and utter fearlessness when trapping large game make them perfectly bred North Carolina hunting dogs, but their loyalty also makes them ideal family pets. "They can be good with children," Lee said at the meeting as Lucy sprawled nearby, but yet you can take them out and they'll fight with a bear to the death. What's more, Swain noted, they'll hunt for their master. They'll protect him. They'll do all these things. Why, hell, a state bird won't do that." The bill was approved that August. A few years later, following the birth of his son, Bob began to reconnect with his roots so that young Jacob Plott would have a better understanding of the family's legacy. In 2007, Bob wrote his first book, Strike and Stay, The Story of the Plot Hound. He's since written five more. The following year, the Plot Hound made his debut at the Westminster Kennel Club dog show And in 2016, Bob was awarded the prestigious Order of the Long Leaf Pine, one of the highest civilian honors granted by the governor of North Carolina. "This has become my life's work," he says. "It's just so rich with history." 10 minutes west of Maggie Valley, on a quiet stretch of the Blue Ridge Parkway, a breeze rattles the wooden signs perched at an overlook some 5,000 feet above sea level. "Before you lies the massive Plot Balsam Range," the sign reads. "On one of its eastern slopes, Henry Plot, a German immigrant's son, made his home in the early 1800s. Half an hour to the east of Maggie Valley, in the Hazelwood section of Waynesville, a bronze statue of a Plot Hound sits next to a plaque that declares the dog one of only four breeds known to be of American origin, originating here in Hazelwood in the 1750s. You can't drive 10 minutes in any direction around these parts without seeing a road or creek named for the Plot family or cabins and houses built by Plots in the late 19th and early 20th century. Even today, Plot descendants own many of the businesses, like the famed Stomping Ground, a country and bluegrass dance club. On the lawn back at the Meadowlark Motel, Corey Plot, owner of Plotware Pottery in nearby Clyde, has a booth set up where he's selling utilitarian ware. When a visitor asks about his name, he smiles bashfully and says, "Yeah, we're pretty much everywhere around here." John Jackson, a former president of the American Plot Association, who helped the American Kennel Club establish standards for the dog, credits the Plot family for their role in the development of the breed. But he says that many others, like the Branchwater Mountaineers, skilled hunters who lived not in the towns and cities or on farms, but in log cabins deep in the hills and hollers, were just as instrumental. Wherever that Branchwater Mountaineer would go when he went out to work, well, the dogs would go with him, Jackson says. And while that man worked, the dogs would be honing up his hunting skills. The crowd around the motel has begun to swell, and Bob scans the festival area with a look of pride. People have traveled here with their dogs from as far away as San Diego and as nearby as down the street. "I'm proud of my family's legacy," Bob says, "but what's even more special to me are all the other folks for whom these dogs are important. My relatives and I may be the only ones here with the last name Plot, but all these other people, people who were friends of the Plot family, people who bred Plot Hounds and love the breed and are willing to travel just to be with others who love the breed, they're the ones who continue to perpetuate the legacy that's so unique to North Carolina." He removes a faded photograph from his family album and walks over to one of the dogs tied to a tree next to the creek. In the snapshot dated 1870, an ancestor stands next to a powerful-looking dog with a big barrel chest and a stately stare. It looks exactly like Stoney, the buckskin Plot Hound that Bob reaches down to pet. "Look at this guy," he says. "I've always said that when you touch the face of a Plot Hound, you're touching the face of history." And now, what do you suppose the state insect is? Well, it's the honeybee. Lessons from the hive. A former hairstylist in Forsyth County turned to beekeeping and agriculture to help children learn about the beauty and wonder of nature. Written by M.E.N. Wright. That's E-M-I-E-N-E. That's a new first name for me. M.E.N. Wright. Walking the grounds of her small homesteading farm in Winston-Salem, Samantha Fox Winship knows that something was amiss. It was like any other fall morning. Sunlight streamed through the crisping leaves, chickens chattered as she passed them, and Scotch bonnet peppers bobbed bright in both warning and welcome. The animals were fine, the crops looked good, and Winship had made it through her first summer of beekeeping. With cooler weather coming in, she felt secure enough to relax a little. Summer is a crucial time for bees. It's when they busily store up honey for the winter. Winship had fallen in love with her new operation. investing hundreds in beekeeping classes and equipment to build up her colony and deliberately harvesting very little to ensure the hive had a surplus of food. The bees, struck by a sudden chill, she sprinted to her hives, already fearing from 100 yards away what she would find. It's an energy thing, Winship says, of the feeling she had. I didn't even go inside to put on my bee suit. I just put my ear to it and then opened the corner of the box. They were all gone. It's called absconding, and it's one of the great mysteries of the beekeeping world. For whatever reasons, the conditions inside a hive become too stressful for the bees, and all or most of the colony suddenly move with their queen. With no honey, no food, and no pollen, any remaining bees have no chance of surviving the dropping temperatures. Winship lost some 50,000 bees the first year, and it broke her heart. I just went in the house and cried. It was a hard lesson, she says. Losing a hive is hard because you get attached to it. 5 years later, Winship has more than recovered. She's built a reputation as the queen bee of North Carolina's honey and established Mother's Finest Urban Farms as a premier educational and community resource for arts and sustainable agriculture. Her honey, produce, tonics, and Scotch bonnet-infused mead are sold across the Southeast. Since 1973, the honeybee has been the official insect of North Carolina. Beyond pollinating crops in our heavily agricultural state, the bee's honey and wax are used in everything from medicine to makeup. Winship, who has a background in early childhood education, knows well the vital role that bees play in ecology. She sees Mother's Finest as more than a means of production. It's a way to ensure that children, especially black children, reconnect with their roles as caregivers of the earth, and that they know about our state's official insect. Winship grew up in Goldsboro, 2 hours from her mother's family in Beaufort. Her great uncle owned a farm in nearby Eureka. Summertime visits with him consisted of playing outside in the dirt and watching out for the bees that were crucial to the plants. It was my happy place, she says, but that changed when the death of her older brother upended the family. Gripped with sorrow, 13-year-old Samantha went to Chicago to live with another uncle who nurtured her entrepreneurial spirit. She embarked on a successful career in makeup and hair artistry, but inside she never quite recovered from the loss of her sibling. My brother was always positive and very protective, and it was a hard place to dig myself out of, she says. Honestly, getting back into nature helped me heal from grief. After relocating back home from the Midwest with her oldest son in tow, Winship eventually decided to try beekeeping. It felt like a rebirth. She was the only black person in her first beekeeping class, which was populated by older white men, some in Confederate flag T-shirts. At first, I was going to leave because I felt uncomfortable, she says, but I just got the strength of somewhere and started to realize that this place needed me here. I'm glad I was bold enough to stay. Now she teaches classes on her own, and her presence in the state's beekeeping industry has been welcomed. One of Winship's students told her that seeing another black woman in the field gave her the confidence to pursue the discipline herself. And when the National Honey Board shot a video of Winship, the crew said that she was one of the few women they'd featured. They were tired of the norm, Winship says. The video, celebrating beekeeping, changing the face of beekeeping, has since racked up more than 2 million views on YouTube. Winship's ultimate goal is to preserve black and indigenous wisdom by passing it on to younger people, by encouraging more people of color to engage not just in beekeeping, but also in other agricultural pursuits. Prior to the pandemic, she held workshops on animal husbandry and beekeeping at schools across the triad. Now, as vaccine efficacy has made in-person learning safer again, she's expanding her educational offerings at Mother's Finest. I'm a firm believer that nature can be one of the best teachers, says Winship, who waxes poetic about the sacred geometry of honeycomb hexagons. She's also passionate about building educational safe spaces, especially for kids of color who may have been discouraged by certain teachers. And her students don't all have to become farmers or beekeepers. They might cure plant diseases, test soil vitality, work, or climate change, she says. We need to have them engaged with conversations like that. Still the old chestnut about a spoonful of honey rings true. Instead of focusing on systemic failures, Winship hones in on solutions and her own cool factor to keep students interested in learning. One way is through fashion. She often wears crowns and is fond of bee-themed jewelry. I'm imprinting in their minds that this, meaning herself, is a beautiful black woman who's intelligent and proud and ambitious and fearless. I'm not just representing myself, but also my family and my ancestors. She aims to help break generational curses of impoverishment, malnutrition, and preventable diseases like high blood pressure and the cancers that took her grandmother and aunt. I want to see healthy families, a healthy community, and a healthy society, she says, and I feel like those conversations are started in households and they become community conversations about wellness, protecting our kids, educating our kids. Another goal is to build a year-round curriculum that exposes young minds to lifelong skills and provides them with something that she didn't have, a role model in beekeeping and agriculture who looks like they do. If that sounds like quite a lot, that's because it is. Fittingly, Winship takes inspiration from North Carolina's favorite insect. Wearing a tie-dye apron and honeycomb earrings, she approaches her hives gingerly. Although they know her scent, she's mindful not to intersect the bees' flight paths. It's a dance that has been practiced and perfected over the past 5 years. Bees have taught me so much, she says. Their life cycles are only 22 days, so they have to accomplish everything they can in that window. She smiles, and look how much impact they have. For more information on Samantha Fox, Winship's products and classes, visit Mother's Fine DurbanFarms.com. And we're not quite going to have time to finish the next article, but let's just get going. I'll try to talk fast. The state bird is the cardinal, wings and a prayer. For an artist in Kernersville, the bird that visits yards and gardens throughout the state across every season is a symbol of hope, comfort, and love, written by Susan Stafford Kelly. With three bird feeders, a bird bath, and a bird house in my backyard, and a paperback guide to birds on my desk, bearing the date I saw five cardinals at once one snowy January day. With the cardinal as North Carolina's official state bird, how have I not known this, heard this, or been aware of this? Call it a notion. Call it a belief or folklore or even a superstition that people the world over equate a cardinal's appearance with a visit, a message from someone who has died. Raymond Reed heard the lore all his life. My grandmother, my mother, always said that cardinals represent a sign from heaven, he says, and mentions Victoria McGovern, whose poem is perhaps the most quoted expression of the legend. May you come to find comfort in and remember, cardinals appear when angels are near. So go now, sit outside and drink your tea. Keep a lookout for the little red bird. It is there your loved one will be. When Reed was still a teenager, her father purchased correspondence art lessons. What today would be considered an online course for his artistically inclined son with an affinity for Andrew Wyeth's work. Reed went on to a career in commercial art at advertising agencies from Knoxville, Tennessee, to the largest ad agency in Greensboro at the time, as well as teaching painting classes. He opened his own full-service agency on State Street in Greensboro in 1987. In 1999, he sold the company, agreeing to a 7-year non-compete clause. That's when I really began painting a lot, Reed says. He began writing humor columns for the Kernersville News in 2003, which helped him cope with his wife's long illness and grieve her death in 2007. He eventually won a first-place national award for his work. Then in late 2018, deviating from his usual figure studies and landscapes, he completed a painting that he titled The Four Seasons, rectangular panels featuring a cardinal in seasonal backgrounds of snow, autumn leaves, the blue hydrangeas of summer, and of course, a spring dogwood. What happened next, Reed himself isn't sure how to explain. I know it sounds corny, but it was almost like divine intervention. He works in watercolor, an unforgiving medium that the artist describes as live fast and die young. Using the wet-on-wet technique, Reed dampens his paper and then applies wet paint so the colors blend. So I put in color, let it run, control it if I can. But something just appeared in the clouds, he says. I squinted and saw it. The it was an angel. And indeed, you must peer closely, gaze beyond and above the cardinal's familiar blood-red rounded belly with a crested head. It's just there, hovering momentarily, a floating figure caught in an updraft, or there within a cloud bank, or there blurred by falling snow. But the flowing hair and indistinct wings might well be mistaken for wispy clouds. The facial expression is calm, softened, serene. The angel may have surprised the cardinal, or it may have been present all along. Spirits are happy accidents, Reed says. When the paint dries, something shows up. As with much art, interpretation is up to the individual who studies it. Reed's love of cardinals had inspired him to join a Facebook group called Anything Cardinals, filled with stories, photographs, and images of the birds. In January 2019, he began posting his cardinal paintings, a series that he has since named Visitors from Heaven, and was overwhelmed with the responses from Iceland to Ireland, Africa to Australia, Turkey to Thailand, whether cardinals are indigenous to the country or not, and particularly from people who had lost a child, a parent, a spouse. People see males, females, likenesses of relatives and the angels, and requests for commissioned portraits with Reed's signature cardinal and unfocused shadowy angels who come from 30 states in Canada. And everyone has heard about the cardinal as a sign. He says, Muslims, Christians, Buddhists, Catholics, doesn't matter their spiritual belief, they relate to it. Often their stories are painful tales of untimely, tragic, accidental deaths. They pour their hearts out to me, he says, but leave the composition up to him. Working from photographs, he's painted 32 portraits of deceased loved ones, aged 4 to 86, and there's a cardinal in each work. I paint the person first, he says, cardinal last, on branches that are always bare. That's my trademark, and whether the cardinal faces outward or sideways is never planned. It just comes to me. The cardinal is never in flight, never with a cocked head, as if asking, should I be here? Is danger present? It is certain, rather, sure of its place. A winged reminder of hope and a symbol of comfort. And that's all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine. Hope you enjoyed it, and then you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving our community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call the studios 919-832-518. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.